Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley. It's the show that aims to get you thinking every Saturday, well, evening now, really, here on Premier Christian Radio. Our new playout time of 6 p.m. A lot has changed in the light of lockdown and coronavirus, including the time at which you can hear Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio. But I hope that if you're a regular listener via the radio station, you've found us in our new slot. And of course, people can listen at any time of the day or night via the podcast. Find it at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And there's all the links there to the extra resources, the app, the newsletter, ways to give, and much more besides. We've been pushing out tons of videos as well on our social media, on our YouTube channel. Me talking to a number of different Christian thinkers in the last few weeks. So if you want to catch up with those, I'm always posting them to the Facebook and Twitter account and so on. And you can get hold of all of them if you subscribe to those channels. We're going to be hearing, in fact, today, a couple of conversations I've been having recently with William Lane Craig and Amy Orr Ewing. William Lane Craig on his response to some of the atheist coronavirus memes going around and his response to the coronavirus itself. Amy Orr Ewing on suffering and God. So listen out for them later on in the show. But we're going to kick off the program today with a debate between Peter Hitchens and Christina Dent on drug decriminalization. Not our normal kind of debate here on the show, but I thought this was a fascinating one when Christina got in touch with me. So we'll be hearing from them both very shortly, a shorter than usual debate for today's show, hence why we're going to be using William Lane Craig and Amy Orr Ewing a little later on in the show. Plus, of course, we'll have your emails as well. You've got some interesting responses to recent editions of the show, including last week's debate on God, Stephen Hawking and the multiverse. So we'll come to all that later on in the show. Right now, let's get into our first debate of today's programme.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, is it time to stop the war on drugs? Something a bit different for you today. An ethical debate as two Christians with very different perspectives on the criminalisation of drug use join me. Peter Hitchens is a columnist for The Mail on Sunday and an outspoken critic of the UK's approach to drug law. His 2012 book, The War We Never Fought, The British Establishment's Surrender to Drugs, argues that an increasingly liberal attitude towards drug use and prosecution in the UK has led to serious problems, especially in the widespread use of cannabis. And he contends the UK never really waged a war on drugs, and it's only through much harsher punishment that the war on drugs can be successful. Christina Dent is the founder of End It For Good, which advocates for decriminalizing drug use. Christina is a lifelong politically conservative Christian in the USA, but has had a radical change of mind after witnessing firsthand the effect of criminalization on drug addicts. And she says that criminalization doesn't work, but merely perpetuates a vicious circle. So I'm looking forward to getting into this topic today, one we haven't ever tackled on Unbelievable before. First of all, welcome, Peter, back to the program. Looking forward to hearing what you have to say to Christina today, who we'll meet in a moment. It could be argued that you've sometimes been seen as a contrarian, not my words, but those of others. And you have, of course, just recently been quite vocal in your criticism of the government's lockdown strategy as well. Just before we get into the issue under discussion today, what are some of your main concerns on the lockdown strategy as it stands at the moment?
Oh, well, if we're discussing that, I think there's a grave danger in crashing the economy. of destroying the lives, prosperity and happiness of very large numbers of people for the foreseeable future and doing grave damage to our society. And if we were faced with something to which this was a proportionate response, I'd be happier. But it seems to me that it is a very considerable overreaction by government to a problem which could be dealt with by more rational and restrained action, as is being undertaken in Sweden. So fundamentally, I think that it's just a mistake. I do hugely object to being referred to as a contrarian, which makes it sound as if I take positions I take as some sort of game or for fun. I take positions I take because my conscience impels me to take them. And I absolutely promise you that if I had joined the consensus choir on this issue, as in many others, it would have had no effect on my career. My employers wouldn't have taken me to one side and said, could you be a bit more noisy or anything of that kind. I do it despite the fact that it tends to earn me a great deal of abuse and I get hosed down with slime on social media. I do it because it seems to me to be true. And as you will know, truth is another name for God. And I stick with that. I think that if it seems to you to be true, then you have to say it. Now, the same is true on the drugs issue. I don't think that any of the arguments for legalization stand up to serious examination. And I have not called for harsher punishments, as you said in your introduction. I've called simply for the use of the existing laws in this country, which have been on statute books since 1971, to deter the use of drugs. And that's all. It's nothing to do with harsher punishment.
Okay. Well, thank you. Let's hear a bit from you, Christina. You got in touch with me suggesting this topic, which we don't normally do on the show, but I thought it would be an interesting one, especially given your background. You say you're a conservative Christian, mm-hmm. But in this respect, at least, quite different to most conservative Christians in Bible Belt America that I know. So what actually led to your change of mind in this particular area?
Yeah, I had a very radical change of mind. I'm an evangelical Christian, politically conservative. I live in Mississippi and work in Mississippi, which consistently ranks as the most religious conservative state in the United States. And I supported the drug war for most of my life. And I just thought, you know, lock people up. They broke the law. You know, it's just the right way to handle that. And what really changed my mind was meeting a woman named Joanne, and meeting her and getting to know her set me on a journey that ended up changing my mind. She had struggled with addiction for many years, and her son was placed in foster care when he was born because she had used drugs prenatally, which is not healthy, of course. And we became his foster family. And so I brought him to his first visit with her, and met a woman there who was not at all like the woman that I was expecting to meet. I was expecting to meet someone who was very much not like me. And what I met was a woman who met me in the parking lot, running across the parking lot with tears streaming down her face, covering her little baby with kisses. And I did not know anything about addiction at this point. It had never come close to me before. And I just thought moms who would use drugs while they were pregnant must not love their children. And so the more that I got to know Joanne, the more I saw she's a mom like me. She loves her son just as much as I love my three little boys. What she's struggling with is a complex health crisis. It's just not a criminal justice crisis. It is not a criminal justice issue. And that really shook me because I knew that we were putting women like Joanne in prison every day in Mississippi. Mississippi has the second highest incarceration rate in the country. The United States has by far the highest incarceration rate in the world. Mississippi is not a place where we are soft on drug laws. We have very high incarceration rates and lots of fallout from that in our families and communities, negative fallout from that. And so I wanted to know, how can we actually reduce drug harms? And that has become my North Star for figuring out what I think the best policy is moving forward with drugs is what actually reduces societal drug harms. And so I backed into legalization as the best way that I think that actually what does that. So I didn't come at it from, I think drugs should be legalized. Now let's figure out how we can make that work. I went on the journey to learn how can we actually have less harm from drugs. And the conclusion that I came to was the best way to reduce drug harms across society, not just for the person who's using, but for their families, for the broader community who's not using, is actually to bring them back into a legal market. And we can talk more about why I think that that actually is going to make life in our world a whole lot better than it is right now. But that's the journey that led me into changing my mind.
Yeah. What led you to write the book, Peter, back in 2012? And do you think the situation is fundamentally the same as it stands with the current approach to drug abuse and so on?
Well, I mean, I don't claim as much knowledge of the situation in the United States as I do in Britain. And the process of the collapsing and abandonment of the laws, particularly against marijuana in the United States, has been different from that in Britain. But I wrote the book because I was tired of people, particularly people in public life and journalism and politics, saying things which were blatantly untrue, such as there is a war against drugs, it is unfairly criminalizing young people, it is like prohibition, it has failed, therefore the only thing we can do is to abandon it. None of this is true, and I established with historical detail and political fact that it wasn't true, and no one has ever challenged anything that I've said, which a book which I published in I think 2012, and remains unchallenged. And the facts in it are all true. There has been no war on drugs. Marijuana has been effectively de facto decriminalized in the United Kingdom, and I might add, in most states of the United States, though it's been achieved under the fantasy of medical marijuana. I was arguing, first of all, that something that was being widely said wasn't true. When I first said it, I was, as usual, derided and hosed down with the usual slime. But as it happens now, pretty much everyone who pays any attention to the position in Britain realizes that what I said all those years ago was true. Well, thanks very much. That's the story of my life. But what I didn't do particularly in the book, which because I was addressing an audience which I knew to be largely irreligious, was to do much more than take a glancing look at the Christian arguments against drug abuse. Because I thought that they wouldn't have any impact on people. I said, well, if you can't look at the Gospels, then try John Stuart Mill. Either under John Stuart Mill or under utilitarian principles, the same answer comes. If you legalize drugs in society, it's disastrous. But from a Christian point of view, one has to say, first of all, that the service of God is perfect freedom, that God has given us the senses which we possess and the bodies that we possess. In trust to use as we should and as we know we should, and that the use of drugs to numb the mind, to change the perception of the truth about the universe, is obviously in itself throwing in the face of God gifts which have been given. And the other thing that it does in many, many cases, and this is a particular tragedy which happens, is grievously to harm the parents of those who take drugs and damage themselves. The enormous, appalling family crises and tragedies which happen when one member of a family becomes a drug abuser are astonishingly miserable, and I hear so many of them all the time. And the other thing we do is we as Christians, we take responsibility for our own actions. And the whole argument about addiction, which is a fantasy without any hard scientific basis, the whole argument about addiction is an argument about personal responsibility. When we say that somebody who takes drugs is addicted, we classify them as a victim of some sort of medical complaint. I promise you, people who have cancer would love to be able to give it up, but they can't. Drug abusers all can, and many of them do. And this pursuit of a medical fantasy that people are compelled to take drugs is an absurdity.
Okay.
The arguments for legalization, none of them stand up. And oddly enough, the success of the legalization campaign, both in Canada and in several states in the United States, has shown this. Far from making the drug more easily controlled and resulting in lower strengths and all that sort of stuff, the legalization in Canada and Colorado particularly has done nothing of the kind, because the illegal market continues to flourish, and so of course do the gangs which are involved. But all these claims that are made for it are simply demonstrably false. So I don't think that there is either a responsible utilitarian or a decent Christian argument for this.
Well, let's hear some responses, at least from Christina. There's lots to respond to potentially there, Christina. I mean, first of all, I suppose it's worth clearing up I'm assuming as a Christian yourself, you're not pro drug use per se. Right. You're not saying you want people to have free access to drugs because you think it's a great idea. So what is it you're saying? What is it what are your reasons for decriminalizing drug use?
Yeah, so I think that's one point to make, is that there's a difference between what I do myself. I've never used an illegal drug. I don't drink alcohol. I've never smoked a cigarette. Like, I have no interest in drugs or drug use of any kind. My interest is in people, and that's why I'm interested in this, because really how we handle drugs is all about how we handle people. And so that's a distinction that I had to make in my mind, was, you know, there's a lot of things that I don't agree with that people engage in that I also don't think they should be put in prison for. I don't think we should have policies that proactively hand them harm that's beyond the scope of the harm that they would, you know, receive from engaging in that behavior themselves. So for me, it was important to begin to realize that actually categories of harm from drugs fall into two categories. I always thought of them as just drug harms. You know, everything related to drugs is just a drug harm. But really, harms come in two categories. One, from the substances themselves, which can do very real damage to your body. And the other is from the harm that comes from criminalizing them. So what happens is that in the market that they operate in, the substance that you're actually buying, and to the consumer, so it's the whole supply and demand chain and what's actually changing hands, harm is increased exponentially in every category when you criminalize. So you take the market and you take it from being a legal regulated market, and you transfer it into the black market. Anytime there's demand for a substance, you're going to get supply for that substance from somewhere. Lots of extra crime.
Do you think that it is analogous to prohibition era in America, where obviously mm-hmm. alcohol was prohibited, was made illegal, and mm-hmm. then you got the rise of the cartels and those mm-hmm. you know, the Al Capones and so on who
but it just isn't just mm-hmm.
But why not? Why do you? I mean, obviously, Christine does think that it's analogous.
Well, no, everything she says. I mean, I don't doubt her sincerity and her goodness as a person. But everything she says is straight out of the playbook of the drug legalization campaigners. I've heard it all before, issuing from their lips. And these people are actually, in most cases, billionaires seeking to replace big tobacco as the biggest.
Well, I'm not, Peter, so you got to respond to me as myself, because I'm not one of them.
I haven't once interrupted you, Christina. They seek to replace big tobacco as the biggest killers for profit who ever existed on the planet, but they kill by a different method. They kill by destroying the mind rather than the body. But this is an enormous, extremely well-financed campaign. Examine the campaign for Proposition 64 in California and see what kind of people are involved in pursuing this cause, and you will see who you are helping. And if I don't actually see why any Christian should want to help such people in the objective that they have. And while they are still prevented from doing what they seek to do, I think we should do everything we can to prevent them. Also, this word criminalize, the taking and the possession of these drugs is illegal. That's one of the main differences with alcohol prohibition. The possession of alcohol was never prohibited under alcohol prohibition, a law which is barely enforced in most jurisdictions anyway. But the point about it is this: if you actually enforce a law against the possession of marijuana, the drug on which I concentrate in these matters because it is so widely used and because so many people foolishly use it, if you pursue a policy of actually penalizing people under the law for possessing it, then the use of it declines. And the particular jurisdictions where this is established are in Japan and South Korea, both of which have absolutely refused to join in the funky hippiedom of the rest of the advanced world and continue to prosecute possession. Now, what happens is, of course, the people who are arrested are not immediately thrown into prison for 500 years. They're warned by the police not to do it again. And if they do it again, then they are indeed punished. That's the way in which criminal law is enforced, and it works. And as a result, you go to Japan and South Korea, there's still strong social disapproval of this activity, and it's not indulged in by responsible people, or encouraged by responsible people, or sympathized with by responsible people, or advanced as some sort of illness to be pitied by responsible people.
Let's allow
crime, and there is less of it. And as a result, there are fewer people becoming seriously mentally ill. And over the weekend, one of the most prominent doctors in the field of psychiatry, Professor Sir Robin Murray, of the Maudsley Hospital in London, an absolute expert on the matter, who has for years hesitated about this, although he sees so many patients whose minds have been overthrown by marijuana use Until last weekend, he had not said what he now says, that legalization is a grave folly and should be prevented. He's always hesitated about it. Now he sees no doubt whatsoever that the use of this drug leads to disastrous results for the mental health of its users. And the only way of discouraging this is the law. And that is a vital moment, it seems to me, in this issue. People should pay attention to people like Ryan.
I'd be interested in your response to this, Christina. Because I was out in California last summer, and what was interesting to me was to see the number of shops selling pot and marijuana and so on, because I think it was legalized for recreational use back in 2016 there, and in a number of other states as well, not just for medicinal use. What's your analysis of what that has led to? Peter obviously believes that legalization, whether de facto by simply not prosecuting or making it legal outright, is not good. And you see the effects of what marijuana does to people. What's your opinion on all of that?
Well, I think you would have to, I think one of the things that people are very concerned about is that if you legalize it, it's going to greatly increase use. And of course, then you get, you know, added harms from, you know, more people using it. And what it seems like from Canada legalizing, from states here that have legalized, is that their adult use does tick up some, usually less than 2 percentage points, sometimes within a percentage point. So you're not getting a lot of increase in adult use, but you're getting, in almost all the states that have done it, you're getting a decrease in youth usage. That same thing has happened in Canada. Their lower teenage years of youth use, which is where we would be very concerned about that, have dropped almost in half since they legalized nationwide in 2018. What I think people need to think about is there are pros and cons on both sides. So yes, there's some cons to legalizing. It makes it accessible to people over 21. There are going to be some people that use it that would not have otherwise. And I think why I can't continue to support that, and I absolutely respect Peter's, what he said earlier about his conscience does not allow him to support legalizing it. My conscience does not allow me to support continuing to criminalize it because of the massive amount of harm that's happening. All of the people who are being killed in violence related to the underground market, they're not just people who are involved in the underground market. They are people that are living in our inner cities where gang violence is racking their neighborhoods, and they're not involved in it, but they're getting caught in the crossfire of that. There are people dying. Mexico's had 150,000 murders from organized crime since they ramped up their drug war in 2006. You have all of this market harm. Then you have what actually happens to the substance itself when you take it out of regulation and you put it into whatever anybody wants to sell you in a bag. So here in the United States, we're in a huge overdose crisis. It's really important to understand where those overdoses are coming from. So in 2018, we had 46,800 people that died of an opioid overdose. But if you look down our own CDC, our Center for Disease Control, their own numbers show that 79% of people who died of an opioid overdose had heroin or fentanyl in their systems. So we're not in a prescription overdose crisis. We are in an overdose crisis being driven by people getting drugs on the street where they don't know the potency, they don't know the purity, they don't know if it's going to get them high or kill them. And that's what you have in an underground market. You don't have any kind of regulatory control over that substance, what people are actually getting. So you have all of these people who are dying of preventable overdoses, all of this market violence that's happening. And then you have what happens to consumers when you criminalize what is a complex health issue. We just don't respond this way to other complex health issues. We don't try to use prison or jail to address them. We have very helpfully addressed tobacco smoking, not through criminalizing, but through really good education, by making it less socially acceptable. And we haven't tried this approach of this nuclear option of incarcerating people.
Okay. Okay. Yes, Peter, plenty to respond to there. I'm sure you'd like to pick a few things.
What I notice about my opponents in this is they never actually listen to anything that I say. I'm used to this, but I dealt with the claim that legalization remove criminals from the scene very early on. It's simply not true. Neither in Canada nor in Colorado has legalization eliminated the illegal market or the gangs or anything else. They're all still there. They're all still working away. And the fundamental basis of all the crime and violence which is connected to drugs is the large amounts of money handed over in payment for drugs by the individuals who use them, who all the major Western jurisdictions treat as victims when they're not victims. You cannot give up having cancer. You cannot give up having tuberculosis. You can give up taking drugs. You don't have to do it. It's against the law. It seems to be an insult to the genuinely sick, who are compulsorily sick, who are conscripts in the world of illness, to compare them with people who voluntarily made themselves ill by the taking of drugs which are known to be dangerous and are also known to be illegal. It simply isn't something that anybody can rationally or rightly say, and people should stop saying it because it is so false. I'd also love to know where the figure comes from about the number of young people using marijuana having declined in Canada, because I haven't, I must admit, seen it. What happens with all these legalizations is that they're preceded by long periods of laxness in the enforcement of law. So you don't get a sudden moment where, oh gosh, something which is rigidly illegal for which you could go to prison last week is legal. You get a shading. So you wouldn't expect a huge increase. The basic difference that legalization makes over decriminalization, and this is incorporated in Proposition 64, a very long document worth reading, is that these drugs begin to be marketed and advertised. And this is the one other point about tobacco. No, we haven't tried to make the possession of tobacco illegal because it would be impossible. Any drug which has been in mass use for more than a century is almost impossible to make illegal once it's been legalized. And this is the problem with the legalization of marijuana. Once we make it legal, it will be almost impossible to call back the terrible mistake we have made once we've made it. That's why we have to be so careful about not making it in the first place. But there is no doubt whatsoever that if you have an effectively enforced criminal law, no one comes near the criminal law for the most part. There's no point in doing it. They know that possession will get them into trouble. They don't possess. The drug market declines. The income from drugs from the countries involved is lower. And in general, the problem is far better dealt with than the ridiculous proposals for legalization, which I understand that some very greedy people wish to pursue and some very heedless people wish to pursue. And those selfish people who want to carry on taking drugs or want to let their children do it pursue. But I cannot for the life of me understand how any person proclaiming themselves to be a Christian could conceivably support such a policy, which will bring so much misery if it comes to.
I mean, give us the other.
I can't believe that anyone can sit there and argue for it.
Well, you're sitting there and arguing for it, Christina. So tell us, why do these benefits outweigh the potential costs that Peter is outlining there? I saw the presentation you gave in your TED talk where you talked about where you do believe you've seen countries that have taken a different approach, have seen very positive results. So you might want to mention some of those as well. Mm-hmm. But okay, give us the other side of this coin, if you would.
Yeah, so there's no countries currently that have legalized all drugs. There are, you know, Canada has done it at the country level for marijuana. There is Portugal, which has decriminalized drug use. So they haven't actually legalized the markets again. You can't buy drugs there legally. So they're still using contaminated substances. But you are not put in jail there anymore for possessing a substance, any substance. And they did that back in 2001 in response to a terrible heroin overdose death rate, very similar to kind of what the U.S. is experiencing, although theirs was even greater than ours is today. And they have followed that over the last, 19 years it is now, and they have found their injection drug use rate has dropped in half. Their drug addiction rate has dropped by a third. I think that's really, for so many families in the United States right now, almost every family has somebody in it who is problematically using substances. They're experiencing the very harmful way that a criminalized approach to that kind of makes addiction feel in a family, a problematic use if you don't want to use addiction. And they found if America could envision one out of three families that are currently experiencing that would not be experiencing that anymore, I think in America we would consider that to be a massive public policy win. Their overdose death rate is very low. Now, Portugal does not have fentanyl in their heroin supply like the United States does. Fentanyl is an extremely potent opioid that makes the margin for error between getting high and death very small. And so it's much easier to die from drugs that are contaminated with fentanyl. And so Portugal has seen great results from this. They also really expanded their public health response and allowing people, tax breaks for businesses that would help people either if they were coming out of treatment or coming out of incarceration to get back on their feet again. And so there's some of that that's more doable in a smaller country that's harder in a large country like the United States. And yet we have seen that what's happening in Portugal is they switch to say, we are going to address a public health issue with a public health response. And they have seen those public health indicators get better with less problematic drug use and less injection drug use, lower HIV infection rates, lower hepatitis C infection rates, all of those things that we would want to see. So I think about it kind of like a pill where half is white and half is red. And half of it is kind of the harm that's caused by drugs, and the other half is the harm that's caused by criminalizing those drugs. And the more and more that I learned about all the different aspects of this really complex issue, the more this red side of harm that's coming from criminalizing has just grown and grown in terms of how much I realize what's actually happening because of all of this harm.
And I do want to finish with Peter because time is drawing to a close.
Well, I have to go very soon.
Another issue. And
I must say here, the Portuguese drug paradise is a myth. And I have devoted a very long blog post to examining this myth and showing in how many ways it is a myth. But simply anecdotally, I'll point out to you that the mayor of Porto, Portugal's second city, has recently come out calling for a change in these laws because he finds their outcome so intolerable. And that marijuana use, for instance, lifetime marijuana use, has increased as a result. I think people should really examine this a good deal more and not necessarily simply look at those reports written by people who agree with them about what's going on in Portugal before accepting it. In any case, as I say, the major Western countries are way ahead of Portugal, if ahead is the word, in having relaxed any attempt to control the spread of the most dangerous drug of all, because it is largely believed by so many people to be harmless, and that is marijuana. And I would hugely recommend Christina to read a book by my good friend Patrick Coburn, one of the greatest foreign correspondents of our age, about the tragedy which occurred to his son Henry. It's called Henry's Demons, which Patrick pretty much is certain was the result of Henry being introduced, as is so common in our decriminalized country, to marijuana in his school at the age of 13. And the terrible tragedy which overtook a boy who I knew before this and whose life has been transformed for the worse and whose family's life has been transformed for the worse by the supposedly harmless drug, which irresponsible and foolish and gullible people seek to make more readily available and seek to make legal so that it can be advertised and sold to yet more people and destroy yet more lives and ruin yet more families. I can say no more about this because I would become actually angry, which would be wrong. But I cannot say firmly enough, this is a terrible mistake. Once made, it will be irreversible. Those who are involved in helping to make it should very seriously examine their consciences before they take a step further. And at that point, I must leave you.
Well, thank you very much for joining us on the line today, Peter. Appreciate your involvement. Christina, thank you also for being with us today. I did just want to give you an opportunity, though, as Peter has said at the outset, that he feels this just isn't an option for a Christian. Well, why do you feel that, in the long term, actually, this is the Christian response as far as you're concerned?
I think, when I look at, can I support policies that are causing death to thousands and tens of thousands of people every year that they continue through preventable overdoses, through the harms of the black market, through the disruption and destabilization of families through the process of incarceration. When I look at somebody like Joanne and I see what could have happened to her if she had been put in prison instead of getting treatment. She's doing great today. She's been 4 years sober. She's a wonderful mom to her little boy. She regained custody of him. She works full time with other people who are trying to get sober. she has had a great outcome. That could only happen because she's not sitting in prison. Nikki is mom very much like Joanne. Her son was also put in foster care with some friends of ours. But Nikki was prosecuted for her prenatal drug use, and she is 2.5 years into a 15-year prison sentence in Mississippi right now for that. That story of Nikki is happening to thousands and thousands of people, just in the United States, much less all the way around the world. And when I look at that, when I weigh those things, I can say, you know what? We live in a broken world with broken people with potentially harmful substances that absolutely can do a great deal of harm to people's lives. So I want to handle those substances in the way that is least likely to cause harm. Put them behind a counter where there's age restrictions on it. Educate people, but don't cause unnecessary death and destruction of life by trying to force people out of using them. And we know that it doesn't work. Almost half of Americans have used marijuana in their lifetime. So the criminalization of marijuana has not worked in keeping people from trying it. And it hasn't kept them from using it. You know, whether or not it's legal, it appears that pretty much everybody who wanted to be using it is using it even when it's illegal. Even in states like ours, where it is prosecuted relatively harshly. And I just think, you know, when we compare those things, I've read a lot. I've read everything that I could in my journey to make up my own mind about this. And I certainly would not have started an organization if I didn't believe very firmly that I actually think this is one of the big blind spots of our generation and one of the greatest policy levers of our time to decrease unnecessary death and destruction and really increase the opportunity to save lives. And as somebody who's pro-life, that's really important to me, and the opportunity to increase the opportunity to thrive for people around the world. And that is absolutely something that I can support as a Christian, as conservative, and as a mom.
Thank you very much for joining us as well, Christina, on the program today. You can find out more about Peter Hitchens at his blog, The Mail on Sunday. That's hitchensblog.mailonsunday.co.uk. And for Christina, it's enditforgood.com. If you want to find out more about the work of End It For Good, I'll make sure there are links from today's show and your podcast as well, wherever you're listening or watching today's program. But for the moment, Peter and Christina, thank you very much for joining me. Feel free to get in touch via email if you want to respond to today's debate between Peter Hitchens and Christina Dent, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Always glad to receive your thoughts as well via our social media channels, @UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page, Justin.Briley over on Instagram. Still to come on the show today, we're going to be hearing from William Lane Craig. He's a well-known Christian apologist, the founder of Reasonable Faith out in the USA, has been known for his debates with atheists over the years. I've hosted him on this show several times and at live events in that kind of context. He's going to be talking to me about what life looks like for him in lockdown and his response to some of the atheist memes that have been circulating in the last few weeks. I'll be here with William Lane Craig very shortly. This is Unbelievable.
Join me, Justin Briley, for a new season of The Big Conversation with world-class thinkers, including Sir Roger Penrose and William Lane Craig on God and the Universe, Bart Ehrman and Peter J. Williams on Jesus and the Gospels. Join the conversation as we explore life's biggest questions at thebigconversation.show.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the show. This is Justin Brierley with you for Unbelievable in its new weekly slot at 6 p.m. on a Saturday here on Premier Christian Radio, or available around the world via the podcaster. It's been interesting to hear, actually, the way that podcasting habits have been changing since lockdown. I myself am finding I'm listening to less podcasts, interestingly,
even though you would in theory think with all this quote-unquote extra time, which actually doesn't really exist for me at least, you might think that podcast listening would go up. But actually, a lot of our podcast listening, as it does for me, happens in those in-between times where you're traveling, commuting, going for a run, driving in the car to do all of those odd jobs and pickups of children and so on. That's not happening so much. So I think actually overall podcast listening is down. But if you are listening, obviously, via podcast, good on you. And for some people, I think it has been going up as well. I've had one or two emails from people who have more time now to listen to podcasts. JD Seltzer is fairly new to the show, says, want to drop you a quick note to say good job. I'm studying apologetics in college right now and stumbled on your podcast because of your appearance on Preston Sprinkle's show. I've listened to quite a few of your latest episodes the last few days and I am hooked. Thanks for having the hard conversations and keep it up. Thank you very much, JD. Glad you found the show. Always good to hear about new listeners. And if you're interested in other people's podcasts, another show listener got in touch this last week. This is Gaia McDermott, who said, I started a podcast just a few months ago from an atheist point of view, connecting to other beliefs. It's a project for 2020 called 52 in 52, as in 52 places of worship in 52 weeks. The coronavirus temporarily shut that down, so I've had to adjust, but thought you might enjoy. I'm new to all this, but enjoying where it's taking me. Gaia, thank you very much for getting in touch. And I did share your podcast over on the Unbelievable Facebook because I listened to the most recent episode where you reflected on that debate I hosted out in California a few years ago now between Ryan Bell and Sean McDowell. And I thought it was very good. I thought you had some interesting reflections on that. You obviously took a lot from what Ryan Bell was saying. And I'm so, I hats off to you for this experiment, rather reminiscent of what I covered a little while ago with another show listener, Tom Newman, who was wanting to try out Christianity. And you're obviously wanting to try the same thing. It may well be beyond just Christianity, of course, the 52 places of worship you're trying out. But anyway, if you want the podcast, it's Face the Sun is what you're looking for, wherever you get your podcast from, with Guy McDermott. Thanks for getting in touch, Gaia. And let's just go to one more before we go to our interview with William Lane Craig in this section of today's show. Magnus got in touch to say he's out in Sweden, Stockholm in Sweden, where they've had a different kind of lockdown to us here in the UK. You say not informal lockdown, no fines, no police on the streets, etc. But in practice, most people respect social distancing, working from home if possible, avoid public transportation, reduce shopping to only necessities, and people in risk groups shouldn't go shopping at all. There's an avoidance of large group gatherings. Most churches are closed and the online service is happening instead. However, we are encouraged to be outside, walking, running, getting some exercise. I hope the pandemic is over soon. My wife, who is working with elderly care and therefore quite exposed, is sick from COVID-19 for the past week and hospitalized since Friday morning, but in rather good shape considering the circumstances. We hope and believe they will let her home any day now. Gosh, Magnus, well, thoughts and prayers with you and your wife in that. And do get in touch to let me know how that situation progresses. I was reading some articles, actually, about the way, though, that overall Sweden has adopted quite a different way of dealing with coronavirus. And I think the jury's still out, as far as I could see from the last articles I saw, as to whether it will pay off ultimately. So good to hear from you, though. And you also wanted to get in touch about the God versus Stephen Hawking episode with Dave Hutching, David Wilkerson and Phil Halper. You say, very interesting, as I did study cosmology when I was young and still very interested in the subject. I have an atheist friend who, like me, is very interested in cosmology as well as faith. However, he's generally an anti-theist, a sort of Richard Dawkins style. We've been discussing arguments about Christian faith versus his atheism for quite some time now, and I've found it hard to rebuke or rebut his strongest argument. Could you help me? His argument goes back to the question, why is there something rather than nothing? We agree that it must be utterly improbable that something as complex as this universe actually exists. Nevertheless, we can't escape the fact that it really does seem to exist. I claim that the eternal, uncreated God created the universe. He replies that in that case, your God must be at least as complex as the universe, probably much more complex, being able to design and create the universe. God must be able to have extremely complex thoughts. Even if he, in one sense, might be said to be as simple as he is not created of many different parts, he still must be able to at least think enormously complex thoughts and to create and control the universe. So stipulating an even more complex God in order to explain the universe doesn't help. We would only need to explain why there is a God rather than nothing. And even if the universe is complex and appears extremely fine-tuned and therefore extremely improbable, an even more complex God is much more improbable, he claims. At least we can have some ideas on how this universe came into existence, though. Thank you. And you go on to say that your strongest arguments for the existence of God are actually more personal, personal relationship, answered prayers, and harder to use, though. Thank you. It's an interesting one that obviously your friend has this idea that if we're going to posit an explanation for a complex universe, the God behind it must be even more complex. That is very much a Richard Dawkins style argument, though he seems to be saying it's the thoughts of God that are complex in that case. I think there have been already some very good responses to this. I would point you in the direction of people like Keith Ward. His book, Why There Almost Certainly Is a God, I thought dealt quite well with some of these objections from Richard Dawkins, and John Lennox as well has dealt with it in various places. I suppose what occurs to me, though, is that there's no particularly logical reason why the preceding causes of something need to be more complex than the effect. I mean, presumably your friend believes in evolution, and that's, I guess, a very good example of complex organisms arising from less complex causes, i.e. a simple law of time, mutation, and the selection effect. So I don't see that it necessarily follows that the cause of something has to be more complex than the effect. And equally, when it comes to God as the metaphysically necessary cause of reality, I just don't see this argument really carries much weight against that. I don't think it even makes sense to speak of the thoughts of God as being complex in the way we would describe, say, physical things as complex. You know, we've almost no clue, actually, as to the essential nature of mental thought. But I don't see any reason to suppose it to be complex in the way that physical things are complex. You know, to all intents and purposes, mental experiences don't appear to me to be complex. They appear very simple. You know, the smallest baby has mental experiences. They don't appear complex in that sense. So I don't really see that this argument does much. I think there is a powerful argument, personally, in the way that why is there something at all rather than nothing? And I think it is very hard to avoid a kind of a first cause that itself must be uncaused. And it's very hard to see how that type of a cause doesn't wear the label God at some level because of the nature of that cause. It's a metaphysically necessary cause, and that is kind of what God is, and it certainly isn't what the universe is. So hope that helps in some way, Magnus. Very interesting email anyway. Glad to hear from you, and obviously again, my thoughts and prayers with you and your wife. We'll get to more of your emails a little bit later on in the show. Right now, let's hear my conversation with William Lane Craig. Well, I'm joined now by William Lane Craig of Reasonable Faith. It's an international organization which is really about helping to defend the Christian worldview. And he's published many books, spoken, debated, and has a popular podcast as well. Many, many videos online too. Bill, thank you very much for joining me on the program.
Certainly.
Today.
Good to be with you, Justin.
Just tell me, first of all, Bill, what's life in lockdown looking like for you and Jan at the moment? Have things changed much for you since the restrictions came into play?
Well, I have to say, I almost feel guilty that it's had so little impact upon my life. I typically spend every day in my study from morning until evening writing and reading, and that's what I've continued to do. I have had to cancel three speaking engagements that would have required travel. But apart from that, this has been a very productive time for me in writing my book on the historical Adam. So I suspect that people like artists, writers, composers, artisans, who normally are sequestered in their study or studio or workshop, don't experience a great deal of disruption. And that's certainly been the case for me.
Are you missing, though, being able to meet with church people on a Sunday? And obviously you run your Defenders classes as well on a Sunday.
That is one major difference. Yes, we're no longer meeting for Defenders. But in this digital age, I am still teaching Defenders every Sunday. We are podcasting it. So I record the lesson And we live stream it at the normal time and then post the video as well. And lately we've even added a hymn, which we normally sing in class, but now we have the music and the words on the screen. And so even Defenders class is going forward. So we're very fortunate with Reasonable Faith being a web-based virtual ministry. All of its activities are going forward pretty much.
That's great to hear. In a way, what would you say are the opportunities that this particular period enforces on people, this lockdown? For a lot of people, that simply means they're at home a lot more than they used to be, probably online a lot more than they might normally be. What opportunities does that present to evangelists and apologists who want to see this time used for good?
Well, of course, we hope that it will make people more reflective. It's very sobering to think that you might die. As an older American myself, I'm supposedly at higher risk, though I have no underlying conditions and I'm very healthy, but it's a sobering thought to think, gee, this could be the way I come to an end through something like this. And so I hope that makes people more reflective about the ultimate meaning and purpose of their existence and to think about the big questions. I also think this is a wonderful opportunity for Christians and others to do more reading. This is a great time to get those books that you've always wanted to read and to spend a few hours a day in study. So I would encourage folks to really use this time to better themselves intellectually through reading some good books.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the specific apologetic issues that this sort of issue raises. Inevitably, a lot of people are going to be asking the question at this point, why does God allow something like coronavirus to suddenly change everything? Why has God allowed a world in which a virus can run rampant in this kind of way? It's the classic problem of suffering. But in this case, it's a specific type of suffering. It's one that to some extent could be argued is not necessarily because of human freedom that we see the coronavirus having its impact. It's part of the nature, if you like. So where would you begin with that kind of a question, Bill?
Well, I've tried hard to find some philosophical insight from this pandemic, but quite honestly, Justin, it really doesn't add anything new. We already have abundant examples of horrible evils in the world to choose from to illustrate this problem. And so there's not a whole lot really new here that adds to what has already been said. I think in this case, we probably have suffering that is the fusion of both natural evil and moral evil, because although the pandemic is caused by a virus, it seems that human factors were involved in its initial careless handling in that laboratory in Wuhan, China, that may have resulted in its being unintentionally released into the world. So there's both the human factor and the natural factor involved. As I reflect on it, it seems to me that one of the things that we might take away from this is that it illustrates so well the point that I've often made in response to the problem of evil, that due to our cognitive limitations, we are simply not in a position to judge with any sort of confidence the probability of God's having morally sufficient reasons for permitting the suffering to occur. I've often pointed out that seemingly trivial events in history can be amplified to have worldwide repercussions, so that we have no idea whatsoever why a certain event might have been permitted by God to occur. And if indeed it's correct that this virus was unleashed on the world through the careless handling of a lab technician in Wuhan, this illustrates so well the fact that a seemingly solitary, trivial event can have truly worldwide repercussions as it's amplified. And we don't even know the reason for the missteps that led to this lab technician's mistake. Was he distracted that day? Was there something on his mind that caused him to be careless? We don't know, but I think we can see from this illustration that seemingly trivial, tiny events can really have worldwide repercussions. And that ought to make us very cautious about saying of any particular evil or suffering that God cannot have, or that it's improbable that he has morally sufficient reasons for allowing it to occur.
Hmm. I must confess, Bill, I'm not as familiar as you appear to be with this suggestion that it may have been a laboratory that was responsible for the outbreak in the first instance. So just for my benefit as much as anything, what's the information that you've been?
Well, this is what we're hearing in the news here in the States these days, that it seems, and of course this isn't certain, it seems probable that the virus was the result of mishandling of experimental viruses or diseases by a laboratory worker in Wuhan who became infected unknown to himself, took it home to his girlfriend, infected her, and thence it spread, and now has affected the entire world. It's really stunning if this isn't
as opposed to the prevailing theory that I'd understood, which is this transfer from bats to humans in through potentially unhygienic conditions in a Wuhan market. But I suppose we will wait to see exactly what the source was.
This all needs to be settled out, doesn't it?
Yes,
the stories that I've heard most recently was that it was political to try to blame it on the Wuhan market rather than on this laboratory was handling various diseases. But we will see.
There will be a lot of investigation, I imagine, into where exactly the blame lies, if anywhere. I suppose ultimately what we're seeing, though, is that very often the natural evils that do exist in the world are often exacerbated by our human freedoms, the way we choose to respond. So I can think of, for instance, you know, earthquakes typically are a natural evil, but they affect those in developing countries far worse than in the West because of the disparity of resources and infrastructure and so on. So there is a degree to which human freedom isn't out of the picture when it comes to these issues.
No, I think that natural and moral evil are just inextricably intertwined in our experience. And if I might say one other thing that occurred to me as I thought about this, I've noticed a lot of snarky comments on the web and social media from unbelievers criticizing believers for taking precautions to protect themselves with regard to the virus. They say, don't they trust in God? I thought they believed that God was in control. Shows they don't really believe. They're just like us unbelievers and taking these precautions. And I think that is just opening yourself up to a sucker punch from the problem of evil, because the lesson of the problem of evil is that God doesn't exempt Christians from suffering in this world. We of all people ought to know that, because we follow a crucified Savior who was innocently tortured and executed. So this idea that Christians ought not to take precautions but trust in God is just extremely naive. Every time we wear seatbelts or are careful getting out of the shower onto the wet floor, we take precautions because we know God has established a world that operates according to natural laws, and that he's not going to preferentially exempt us from the consequences of those laws.
And you know that those skeptics would equally be quick to blame the Christians if they didn't take precautions. You can't win either way, can you?
You can't. That's really true.
I mean, you've responded to many an atheist internet meme in your time, Bill. But another one that I've seen doing the rounds whenever I've posted content on my channels from atheists is a picture of Jesus pouring a vial of, you know, some sort of virus onto the world and saying, now I'm just going to add a little bit of coronavirus into the mix. And there's this sense that many people have this idea of a God who is essentially some sort of sadist, you know, willing these acts to happen and for pain and misery to occur. How do you best answer that? And what is the best picture of how we see God despite these kinds of events and circumstances?
I think we emphasize that according to the Bible, God's overall purpose for the human race is to lovingly and freely bring them into an eternal saving relationship with himself. This life is not all there is. And therefore, the purpose of life is not happiness in this life. Rather, God's goal for human history is to freely bring men and women into an eternal love relationship with himself. And that is an incommensurable good, not simply because it's eternal and everlasting, but because God is himself infinite goodness and love. And so to be in a personal relationship with the infinite good is incomparable. And so when God permits horrible suffering in this life, it is only with a view toward accomplishing his ultimate purposes, which is to bring people freely into relationship with an incommensurable good that far outweighs the shortcomings of this finite existence.
What comfort can we give, nevertheless, for those who are feeling the sting of the pain and the suffering, for those who either themselves or have close ones who are suffering from this virus, or the knock-on effects economically and so on of what it may mean for jobs and so on? What would be your advice at a pastoral level, I suppose, for people?
I think here the resurrection of Jesus, which we just celebrated at Easter time, is the basis for our future hope. The Apostle Paul says that even though our outer nature is wasting away, nevertheless, we have this hope of glory beyond all comparison to what we suffer here. And that is not pie in the sky. It is grounded in the historical resurrection of Jesus from the dead, who was the forerunner on our behalf. And that event, I think, as I've argued, is historically credible and well attested, and provides a solid basis for hope for the future, even in the face of the terrible limitations and suffering of our finite existence on this planet.
I've often felt that pain and suffering, as much as for some people it tends to make them drive them away from God or to blame God, for others it actually causes them to draw close to God. And as C.S. Lewis famously said, pain is God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. How do you hope that God may yet use this situation to draw people to himself? Do you see that happening even now?
Oh, I think that what you just said is very true, Justin, and can actually be, I think, empirically demonstrated. When you read a missions handbook about the growth rates of Christianity around the world, what you find over and over again is that in countries that have suffered terrible natural and moral evils, countries like Ethiopia, El Salvador, Indonesia, China, and so forth, the growth rates of evangelical Christianity are multiple times the population growth rate. Whereas in the comfortable, indulgent, materialistic nations of Western Europe and North America, there the growth rates are basically flat. So that, as one person pointed out to me, it's almost as though God has disfavored these comfortable Western nations by not allowing them to suffer in the way that much of the world suffers. So I think you're quite right. When there is terrible suffering in our lives, it does prompt us to turn to God for a source of comfort and hope. But when things are easy going for us, then we tend to be forgetful of God. So as you say, it's a kind of heads I win, tails you lose situation. If things are going well, people don't think they need God. If things are going bad, then they blame God.
Yeah.
What's God supposed to do?
I suppose my hope in this, and I don't know what yours might be, Bill, is that the church will be ready and Christians would be ready to meet people where they are as they experience these questions. Because for many people, I've noticed just in my own social media timeline and as we broadcast services online and so on, lots of people that I wasn't expecting to be watching and to be looking for some kind of hope appear to be suddenly searching. How can churches and Christians be ready, I suppose, in these uncertain times to make sure that we don't miss what God may be asking us to do right now?
Well, I think we need to be equipped with good answers. First Peter tells us that we should always be ready with an answer for those who ask us, a reason for the hope that is in us. So we need to talk about the problem of evil and try to understand how one might rationally respond to it. But then what you just said, Justin, also brings another very important thing to the fore, and that is that Christians themselves are deeply involved in the social response to those suffering from this virus. Organizations like Samaritan's Purse are building clinics, staffing hospitals, going to nursing homes and helping those who are shut in there. All, I think, around the country, probably around the world, Christians are engaged in meeting the medical and economic needs of people. And that hands-on kind of Christianity, that tangible demonstration of the love of God for people, I think is a powerful witness to the truth of the gospel.
Well, we can pray, obviously, that it will be an opportunity for many people to be introduced, perhaps for the first time, to a God who is there, even in difficult circumstances. Sometimes it is those circumstances that force us to seek that God out. But for now, thank you very much, Bill. Bless you and Jan as you continue in your ministry. We look forward to hopefully seeing you in person at some point once restrictions are lifted again.
I would love that. I would very much like to be back in the UK again. So all the best, Justin. Stay safe and keep up the good work.
Well, bless you. And I can tell you that it seems a long time ago now, but that video we shot with Roger Penrose for our Big Conversation series has just had such an enthusiastic reception since it was put out at the end of last year.
And it was a great privilege to be on with Sir Roger, and I am thankful to you for affording me that opportunity.
No, well, I can hardly think of a better matchup, in all honesty. So I was privileged to be there myself. But in any case, blessings to you, Bill. All the best, and we'll see you again hopefully in the near future.
Good. Bye.
Well, you can catch that conversation with William Lane Craig over on our YouTube channel. It's available if you click through from today's show, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable, and a clip that we've played out on our social media of the response to the atheistic memes going on around coronavirus has also done quite well over on our Facebook channel and Twitter account as well. Still to come, Amy Orr Ewing of RZIM is going to sit down to chat with me from lockdown from her home. She's got three young boys and her husband, so they're all in this together, as we all are. We'll be hearing from Amy and a bit more of your emails on recent editions of the show as well. That's still to come on this week's edition of Unbelievable. We'll be back very soon.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to the final part of this week's edition of Unbelievable. Something of a smorgasbord of stuff for you on today's programme. We had a sort of shorter than usual debate up at the front of the programme between Peter Hitchens and Christina Dent. Be interested in hearing your response to that. Again, you can email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Or get us via our social media platforms at UnbelievableJB for Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB. And then we've had William Lane Craig. And in a moment, I'm going to be talking to Amy Orr Ewing of RZIM. She's got a new book coming out later on in the year, but it's very relevant to what's going on in the world just now. So I'll be talking to her in a moment. Next week on the show, if you come back, well, we've got two things, actually. I'm going to try and put out an extra edition of the podcast for all you who just love an extra bonus edition of Unbelievable midweek. The long awaited and promised chat from me, my own talk actually, on why doesn't God end coronavirus and mend the world? That was recorded actually for Spring Harvest, who were doing everything online last week. But going to put that out here on the podcast, and it should be up by the time that goes out as well on our YouTube channel as well. Be interested in your responses to that. I think that will provoke some interesting responses from across the board, both Christians and atheists who may disagree with some of the things I have to say on that one. And then next weekend, a week out from now, we've got a debate for you on can atheists believe in meaning? I'll tell you more about that on next week's show. So thanks to those who are still getting in touch as well about recent editions of the show. The one we did at Easter between Jonathan McClatchy and David Johnson, continuing to get your thoughts going. Deborah Roberts out in Burlington, Canada, emails to say, hope you and your family staying well during this COVID-19 time. Listening to the debate a week ago, I was one of the listeners. Very surprised to hear about 9 other biblical resurrection stories. Well, I've been reading my Bible for over 50 years, and I've never read about any resurrection stories except Jesus. Yes, there were a number of people in both the Hebrew Scriptures and the New Testament who were raised, and you've given the Greek for that, from the dead. But resurrection, and I assume the Greek you've given there is anastasis, is not the same thing. Paul describes resurrection in 1 Corinthians 15 as a different kind of body. That is the answer to the question, why didn't the disciples recognize Jesus immediately? It was very different, but the same. So David's questions would have been answered more simply if the terms had been defined more precisely. Thanks for continuing to provide thought-provoking discussions. Thank you very much, Deborah. And here's another one from Dr. Luke Tarasenko, who had... yeah, some quite interesting thoughts on this. Said, long-time listener, first-time emailer. Since the coronavirus situation happened, I have become my toddler daughter's primary carer while my wife works on her Cambridge Theology PhD and trains for Anglican ordination. So I have slightly more time to listen to podcasts and even write to their hosts. You say, thank you for a fantastic resurrection debate episode for Easter. It was highly energetic and provocative. Great fun to listen to. When David said about the accounts of the saints rising in Matthew, it bothered me a bit. Despite being evangelical and trusting the historicity of these texts, I've often found that passage difficult. On face value, it can indeed read a little like a legendary tradition that's been chucked into the mix by Matthew without solid basis as fact. However, I failed to see why this should invalidate the accounts of the resurrection of Jesus. Say it invalidated Matthew as a source, as David argued, which of course it doesn't even necessarily do, especially since all kinds of scholarship would argue that each of the Gospels is a cobbling together of multiple sources and traditions. Well, that would still leave the Markan, Lucan and Johannine accounts, as well as the other resurrection testimony in the rest of the New Testament, every single document of which presupposes the resurrection of Jesus. Furthermore, it seems to me that whether or not the saints rising tradition in Matthew is factual doesn't really matter, although I do trust it to be true. Even if I didn't believe in the saints rising story, it is only 2 verses, as David pointed out. It's not a key article of the Christian faith, and it doesn't affect any key doctrine. I don't think I've ever heard a sermon preached on it, though I'm sure they're out there, or seen it crop up in a creedal affirmation of the Christian faith. The really important question is not did some people in Jerusalem rise from the dead at the same time as Jesus, but did Jesus rise from the dead? And that is why the Gospels give so much attention to the latter and so little to the former. And the presence of the saints rising tradition does not undermine the wealth of evidence presented by the Jesus resurrection traditions. And you go on to give some more examples of the ways in which that account has and hasn't bothered you and so on. But I thought you had some interesting thoughts to share. Sorry, I haven't got time to read them all out, Luke. Just in response, I would say I think I agree with you. I take that general approach of saying it may be less historically plausible in an objective sense, you know, if you're from a purely academic historical sense, but not so much that it really makes much difference to the overall account and Jesus's resurrection and so on. And those who are into these things may be aware that Mike Licona took some flack from some quarters a couple of years ago for opting with the view that this was a piece of effectively sort of theological writing rather than history from Matthew at that point. But personally, I actually think it's a sign of the strength of the overall text that this one relatively brief part of one account raises these kinds of questions. I think that says something about the overall strength of the rest of the text. And personally, like you, I don't find the manner, you know, I don't find it particularly problematic. I almost see it, if we are to take it at face value, almost as a signaling the way in which Christ's death, which is where it comes in the Matthew account, sort of involves some sort of thunderbolt of divine power sort of ripping through the place and has all these bizarre effects, the tearing of the curtain, the raising of the dead and so on. There was actually, what your email prompted me to remember, there was an interesting discussion about this on the Mere Fidelity podcast. So if you've got time for podcasts, you might want to check that out as well, Luke. You'll have to go back a bit in their archive. I think it was on the titled The Weirdness of Matthew 27, 51 to 54. So that may be helpful. Anyway, good to hear from you. Thank you. You can email in your thoughts as well about anything you hear on The Unbelievable Show, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And here's something I'm just going to recommend as well that is available. I've posted it up on the Unbelievable Facebook channel this last week. But Premier Christianity Magazine, brilliant monthly Christian magazine. If you're not a subscriber, especially in the UK, I do encourage you to get hold of it. But one article I posted that's been provoking quite a lot of commentary on my Facebook and Twitter account, they title, "I Saw Angels Hovering Over My Daughter's Body." It is the extraordinary story of Nadim Ednan Leparus, who describes in it the moment his daughter Natasha had a severe allergic reaction to a pret-a-manger sandwich on an aeroplane and died by his side. It's absolutely tragic and moving story, and in fact became something of a national story at the time, and led to actually a change in the law regarding the packaging of products when it comes to allergy information. But the story that hasn't really been told is Nadim's own story of how this all led him to faith in Christ, and this extraordinary part of the story about this very vivid vision he had of angels over the body of his daughter at the time she passed away. If you want to read something quite thought-provoking, extraordinary, then do go and check that article out. "I Saw Angels Hovering Over My Daughter's Body." You can find it at the Premier Christianity Magazine website, or, as I say, we've posted it up on the Unbelievable Facebook in this past week. Right now, it's time for the final conversation in today's show. Well, Amy Orr Ewing joins me now. She is an evangelist, author, and speaker, and senior vice president of RZIM. She has a book coming out later in the year, "Where Is God in All the Suffering?" And I'm looking forward to having her on properly, maybe on Unbelievable at some point, to talk about that. But for now, she's joining me, like everyone is, from lockdown at her home. Welcome along, Amy.
Thank you. Hi, Justin. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing, though? I know you've got three boys. I'm sure you're going through all the same issues around how to keep them occupied and make sure they don't, you know, have some kind of an education at this point and so on.
Yeah,
What's it like?
It's okay. I mean, I'm sure everyone's struggling with it. We're doing our best with online schooling. I think I've realized I'm the only introvert in a house of raging extroverts who are also sort of fanatical athletes and can't, wow, you know, go and compete in their chosen sport. So feeling really grateful for a garden. I know that lots of people are doing this without outside space, and I mean, hats off to anyone coping with that. It's hard, isn't it? But also finding glimpses of grace in it, time together as a family, you know, we sort of swing between the moments and the actually this is really good that we've got all this time together. So lots of mixed emotions.
Lots and lots of sympathy for you for that. We have four children in our family, and we also have the benefit of a garden at least. And I appreciate all those who don't. And that's a great blessing. But with the best wind in the world, there are moments of tension when people are trying to do what they need to do, but they're having to adapt to new routines and so on.
World, isn't it?
Yeah. We are living in unprecedented times. That's become an overused phrase in some ways, but this is a unique moment in world history, it seems to me. So what are your thoughts on the big picture for how this might affect the church long term, what we're doing in the meantime, what this means for the world? I mean, those are huge questions, I know, but what are you seeing just from where you are at the moment, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right, Justin. This is a moment that most of us didn't really expect to live through in our lives. I'm really aware of how this pandemic is affecting the poorest. And, you know, I work with a global team, including teams in Africa and the Middle East, and you're just hearing of the utterly kind of crushing and devastating impact of a pandemic like this there. And then also here, I think all of us, certainly in my church and just in the community where I live, people that I know, we all know people who've lost parents, who've lost loved ones, or, you know, have had loved ones in intensive care that may have pulled through, but, you know, you've really gone through that agony of potentially losing them and being distanced, not being able to be there at the bedside. So all of that, I think, just massively shapes the psychology, the economy, you know, the world that we're operating in. And for us as Christians, I feel like there's a sort of wake-up moment. When the reality of death feels closer than it's ever felt before, I think that's a challenge to us as we're asking ourselves, what are we living for? And do we really believe in the resurrection of Jesus? And do we really believe in the hope of the gospel? And it's a sort of amazing opportunity in a way to talk about the deeper things of life and eternity and all of that. I think also in social justice terms, I'm really reminded of the context that the early church flourished in. You know, between AD 249 and 262, there was a huge pandemic. The Western sort of civilization was really taken out by, I mean, there's one source that says 5,000 people died in one day in Rome at the height of that pandemic. Wow. That's the context that the early church worked in. And Christian love and the sacrifice of believers of going to nurse unbelieving neighbours and dying of the pandemic themselves, that the sort of sheer love of the church actually turned the Roman world upside down. It kind of really contributed to the evangelisation of Europe. So I feel like there's a sort of prophetic moment for us as the church to really love radically and to love like Jesus did. Not to sort of earn favor with people, not that being the motivated by God's love, but knowing that we might see amazing breakthrough as we do that.
Yeah. I know that you've got a book coming up now. It's a little way off at this point, but funnily enough, it is a book on suffering. It's called Where Is God in All the Suffering? I guess when you were writing, you had no idea of the context within which that book will eventually be released. But where do you begin with that particular book? Because very often this can be treated as, certainly in apologetic circles, as a sort of philosophical problem to be dealt with. But that's kind of not the way you want to try and treat it too much in the book, isn't it? I think you begin very much from a pastoral angle and saying the way that suffering affects most of us is emotionally primarily. So tell us where the book came from and what people can expect from it.
Sure. Thanks, Justin. And thanks for reading it as well.
My pleasure.
It's not coming out till September. And I have actually been able to put some stuff about the pandemic in. The publisher was really kind about that. So I have been able to reflect a bit on that in it. For me, the question of suffering, as someone who's worked as an evangelist and in apologetics for over 20 years, it's obviously a question I've thought a lot about. And for me, I think it's hard to disentangle the logical question, how could there be a loving God and this be the lived experience of billions of people suffering, including something like this pandemic? And so that is a logical question, and that is a question that is a heartfelt and lived question. And I think sometimes the problem with apologetics has been to treat it primarily as a logical question. But sometimes the problem in the church is that we haven't even begun to address it as a logical question. So I'm trying to do both in the book, and hopefully it doesn't feel too sort of heavily philosophical, but I'm aiming that it would actually feel honest. But this is a real problem, that God is loving and that we experience the world in the way that we do. And so as I was thinking about how to approach it, I really wanted to approach it through the lens of love and the unique position in the Christian faith of love, that love is the defining characteristic of God, and that it just impacts how we see everything. So the reason that suffering feels so awful is because of love, because we question, you know, am I really loved if I'm going through this? And because we love others who go through terrible things, that's why then those terrible things hurt. So really, I was trying to kind of approach the subject through that, not minimizing the power of the logical question and seeking to really try and address that honestly, but also, I guess, drawing on what is so wonderful and actually unique about what the Christian faith has to offer. Because let's just take, you know, one small sort of seam of this. If we were to say, you know, within a kind of secular worldview, if there's no God and life is just an accident of physics, chemistry and biology, why do we feel as we do when blobs of atoms suffer? Why does it matter? And when you think about it like that, the answers that secularism offer us don't make anywhere near as much sense as what the Bible offers us. Suffering matters because human beings have been made in the image of God, and life is ultimately sacred, and love is a real category. That's why we hurt. You know, so within the Christian worldview, we're given a kind of framework that actually makes sense of the human lived experience. But we're not just left there, we're also met by a God who enters the suffering world and suffers himself with us and for us. And that's just enormously powerful. Yeah. There's this promise of an experience of love and presence, even in the suffering. Yeah, so sorry, loads to say.
You're encapsulating so much there, really helpfully, actually. But I guess one of the things I've noticed in this current situation is I seem to see two different reactions to this. Some people, maybe, you know, some of my more hardened atheist friends on Facebook and so on, saying, well, just goes to show there's no God, it's just nature taking its course, whatever. Yeah. And others, interestingly, who some quite surprising people seem to be opening up, they seem to be saying, actually, I'm not sure my life makes much sense now, because suddenly all of the securities I had have been taken away. And so I think for some people, suffering kind of, they think, okay, I'm ruling God out now. For other people, it actually opens the door, interestingly, to thinking about what's important in life. And we see that kind of the silver linings, if there are any, as I see it in this crisis as we're experiencing here in the UK, is people are suddenly realizing what's important to them. And that actually, when you can't have all the things that you once had, actually relationships, love, kind of that group unity and solidarity of being in this together, suddenly those things, you know, become important. And my hope, I suppose, is that will point beyond itself as well to the God who kind of undergirds all of that. So I don't know what your thoughts are on whether suffering ultimately pushes people away or brings them towards God.
Well, I think I agree with what you just said there, Justin, that it's both, and people react very differently to the same set of data and the same set of experiences, I guess. And I think that now is an opportunity to speak into both reactions. So I think the reaction that says, oh, this just proves there's no God, there is something to say to that. You know, John Lennox has got this book, Where is God in a Coronavirus World, that's just come out. And he really looks at that in looks in that book specifically at the question of viruses and sort of draws out the research from that female scientist at Pennsylvania State University who talks about how viruses are actually needed for the planet to flourish. It's less than 1% of viruses that are harmful. And so there's still explanation within Christian faith as to how there could be this virus. And at the same time, the gospel speaks to those who are searching, for whom this is a wake up to ask, is there more to life than this kind of hamster wheel of, you know, urgent acquisition that I've been living on, of competitive consumerism, or just so taken up with banal aspects of life, my job or whatever. And this is a moment to press stop on all of that and to ask, what is life really about? And into that question, again, I think the gospel uniquely speaks, because you know, we've just been celebrating Easter. There's this moment in history where God has actually come and evidenced himself and proven his claims to be God and to be the creator and to be the source of love by rising from the dead and ultimately to have power over death. And that is just such a tremendous message of hope right now at this time. And then that same God offers to encounter us, to actually meet us with his presence. That's a testable claim as well. That he can pour his love into our hearts even in the darkest moments. So I feel like it's a really wonderful time of opportunity and of reflecting on the deeper things of life.
Now look, as I wind this interview up, I've been speaking to a number of Christian thinkers about these issues in the last few weeks, but none of them have as fascinating a picture in their background as you do, Amy. So I want to ask you, tell us about this fascinating picture? And I have a feeling I've seen similar pictures like this before, but perhaps you could explain what this picture is behind you.
Sure. Yeah. So this is a picture by the artist Charlie Mackesy of the prodigal son being embraced by the father. And the writing says this is the story of the prodigal son, and, you know, kind of tells in very brief form that story from Luke's gospel. And you may be familiar with Charlie Mackesy from the pictures he's done that are all over the NHS and that book, the Fox, the Mole and the Horse, amazing artist, Christian artist. He actually led my husband to Christ my husband was 14. He was a teenager on a sort of Christian camp. And when Frog, my husband, got ordained, I got in touch with Charlie and asked if I could sort of commission a piece of artwork for him, and this is what he did. And he's done quite a few of these prodigal sons, and there's also a daughter one you can see, and it's just tremendously meaningful for us because it speaks of that God of love who embraces anyone who will come, however far off we've been. We may have been living miles away from him, his kingdom, his priorities, but that embrace of the Father because of Jesus the Son is possible, that we can be that Son embraced by him. So that's what that picture is.
It's a beautiful picture. No, God bless you, Amy. And what a great sort of message to have emblazoned in your sitting room or wherever you're sitting right now. God, who welcomes us all. All the best for you and your family, Arzim, and all the work you're still doing.
And for you, Justin, and everyone at Premier Radio and everyone listening, thank you.
Thanks for being with us on today's show. Hope you've enjoyed our smorgasbord of different bits and pieces. Can atheists believe in meaning? That'll be our debate on next weekend's show. But in the meantime, between now and then, aiming to put out something else extra on the podcast, which is my own talk, my own thoughts on why doesn't God end coronavirus and mend the world. Be interested in your reactions to that as well. Until then, have a great week. You can find out more about today's show over at the podcast page, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. In the meantime, have a great week. Stay safe and see you next time.
You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.